You're listening to audio from North Monroe Baptist Church. To find out more about the church or donate to this ministry, visit northmonroe.com.
We've been talking about the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, looking specifically at the introduction to that, what we call the Beatitudes. That comes from a Latin word that has to do with happiness. And so what Jesus does in the introduction to the Sermon on the Mount, he gives us these eight insights into what it means to be genuinely happy. And normally when you and I talk about happiness, we talk about it in terms of getting something or something, some happy, good experience happening to us or having our way or something like that. Because in our world, happiness is always tied to something happening, right? And yet when Jesus begins to unpack this thing, it has nothing to do with good things happening or you getting your way. In fact, just the opposite seems to be the case. And so when you look at it from our world perspective on what happiness ought to be, and you see what Jesus is saying is happiness, we're left with this sort of profound paradox. And Jesus does that intentionally. Because a paradox, as I've said, is truth standing on its head. It's not going to just let you pass by. It demands that you take a second look. And paradox means that you need to pick this thing up and you need to examine it carefully. And that's what we've been doing. And we've gone through the first seven of the Beatitudes and now we're to number eight. And I really don't have time to go back and summarize each of these Beatitudes. But I would say this, if you're really wanting to learn more about this, we're putting all of this stuff online. You can go back and you can watch it and you can catch up. Either at the North Monroe website or through the North Monroe app so that you can kind of understand the overall teaching, because number eight is different than the rest. It's even more absurd. And so let's just get at it. Matthew chapter 5, verse 10. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness. Now, remember, don't let that word blessed throw you off the scent. The word blessed is a spiritualized way of saying happy. He's saying profoundly happy are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And then he goes on, verse 11. He says, blessed are you, happy are you, when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. And we are left with a ridiculous statement. Why in the world would that be something that would make us happy? And so we've got to stop, we've got to take a second look, we got to pick this thing up, turn it upside down and say, what exactly did Jesus mean by saying, happy are the persecuted? And the first thing that immediately jumps out at me is persecution happens. Did you notice something about this Beatitude? All the other seven Beatitudes are done in one verse. Blessed are the poor in spirit, there's the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who are merciful, they shall receive mercy. Blessed are you when you hunger and thirst for righteousness, you'll be filled. But this one takes three verses. And because this one takes three verses, what we see is Jesus is fleshing this out a little bit more. He's unpacking it a little bit more because this is really the culmination of everything that he's already said. In fact, if you live the first seven Beatitudes, you can be pretty certain that you're going to experience number eight. John MacArthur said this, the Lord's opening thrust in the Sermon on the Mount climaxes with this great and sobering truth. Those who faithfully live according to the first seven Beatitudes are guaranteed at some point to experience the eighth. And so, as we pick this up, we want to look at it carefully. Pay attention, for example, to the pronouns and to the verb tenses. For example, in verse 10, he says, blessed are those. Do you see that? That's a third person pronoun. That's them, they, those other people. That's not us. Blessed are those, and look at the verb tense, who have been persecuted. It's past tense. So it's those other people who have experienced persecution. But then look at what he does in verse 11. He changes the pronoun. He says, blessed are who? You. You see that? Now it's no longer about them, it's about us. And it just got personal. And the verb tense changes, it's not past tense, blessed are you when you have been, but it's blessed are you when you are. In other words, this is future and present. Implying that this is something that we are all going to experience. We are, as followers of Jesus Christ, expected to experience persecution. And when I read this the first time, I thought, you know, I wonder if the disciples really understood this. I wonder if they really, what were they thinking? Because when Jesus said this, this is pre-persecution Jesus. This is popular Jesus. This isn't persecuted Jesus. This is Jesus walking around with thousands and thousands. You know, at one point he fed 5,000 with five loaves, but it wasn't just 5,000. That was 5,000 men, probably closer to 15, 20,000 people following him around. And that must have been an intoxicating experience for the 12 disciples. Remember, Matthew chapter 5, 1 says, when he saw the multitudes, he went up on a mountain. Because he is so popular at this point, he's got to get high. This is like Woodstock stuff. He's got to get to a point where there's room for everyone. And it says, and when his disciples came to him. So his disciples come in and they sit around him. They're right there by him, you know. And he begins to teach them. And that question was always, is he teaching the disciple? Is he teaching the masses? And I think he was doing what we do as pastors in a wedding, you know. In a wedding, we'll always talk to the bride and groom. They're not listening to us. So we're talking to the bride and groom, but through them to everybody else. So what we're saying about marriage, we really intend for everyone else to hear. And so Jesus is teaching the disciples, but in the process of doing that, he's teaching these masses. But don't miss this moment. These disciples are right next to Jesus, and Jesus is the most famous man in their world. There's a tendency in all of us to borrow fame, right? We just naturally do it. Whenever you see a famous person, what's the first thing you do? Well, a lot of people. You go up to them and you get a picture, you know. It used to be you'd ask for an autograph, but an autograph's no good, you know. Because if I get their autograph, what do I have? I have something that I can show you or you or you. I can show three or four people. But if I got a picture, I can post it and show everybody. And when everybody sees my picture, since I'm near someone famous, I'm a little famous too, right? I've told y'all this story before. It's one of my favorite stories. I have this goofy friend named Matt Barnhill. He's actually a psychologist counselor in Houston. And Matt Barnhill, back in 1980, was working the Texas Youth Evangelism Conference at the Tarrant County Convention Center in Fort Worth, Texas. He was like a grunt just doing stuff for free, but he got a free hotel room. And so he's put in the convention hotel. They had this big convention. Back in those days, they had like 17,000 students at the Texas Youth Evangelism Conference there at Tarrant County Convention Center. It just so happened that the very next day, the Bee Gees were scheduled to do a concert, you know. The Bee Gees, like the disco people, you know. At that moment in 1980, the Bee Gees were the most popular group in the world. In the world. You know, Saturday Night Fever was out. John Travolta was doing his thing. All that, you know, staying alive. That's Bee Gees stuff, you know. And they're staying in the same hotel. So Matt and them are packing up to leave. The Bee Gees have just moved in. Word gets out the Bee Gees are at this hotel. There's like 7,000 screaming girls down in the lobby trying to get a look at the Bee Gees. So Matt and them are standing at the elevator. They punch the button. The door's open. It's the Bee Gee band on the elevator going down to the lobby. Now Matt and them don't go, we'll wait for the next one. They step on. They're now with the Bee Gees band, and they realize immediately their good fortune, so they start mussing up their hair and unbuttoning their shirts, and they're trying to look like band members. And he said, when the doors opened, there was a deafening roar. And he said, security had to part the people like Moses parted the Red Sea. And he said, we made sure that it was a Bee Gees band member and one of us, and a Bee Gees band member and one of us. And he said, as he was walking through that line, girls were just trying to touch him, screaming, kind of falling back. He said, that's the closest I've ever felt to being worshipped. And the truth of it is, When we're near somebody with great fame, we borrow that fame. Jesus was the Bee Gees, only without all the polyester and hairspray. And the disciples were the band. And everybody in the world was adoring them, even worshiping them. And then all of a sudden, Jesus starts talking about being persecuted. Do you think they really got it? You see, I have no doubt they didn't get it. I know they didn't get it because they were like us and we don't get it. We just can't see that persecution is part of the godly life. We want the crown, but we want to avoid the cross. And, you know, right up until as late as the Lord's Supper, they were still arguing about who was going to be greatest in the kingdom of heaven. They didn't get it then. They didn't get it for a long time, but they would eventually get it, because here's the thing about the disciples. They may have failed the lecture, but in the real world praxis, they all graduated summa cum laude. Of the 11 remaining disciples after Judas, here's what happened to them. Simon Peter was crucified upside down. Andrew was crucified. James was beheaded. John alone survived to old age, but he was boiled in oil and banished to Patmos. Philip was crucified. Bartholomew was flayed alive. That means he was skinned alive and then beheaded. Matthew was killed by a halberd. Thomas was thrust through with a spear. James the lesser was beaten with stones. Simon the zealot was crucified. And Judas, the son of James, Thaddeus, was crucified. And here's the thing I suddenly remembered. If God didn't spare the lives of his disciples, then why would he spare my reputation or my convenience or my comfort? You see what I'm saying? If he didn't spare them, then why would he spare us? And two quick insights emerge. Here it is. Persecution is inevitable. Don't be surprised by it. 2 Timothy 3:12 says, all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. So if someone does persecute you for your faith, then just know that goes with the territory and don't freak out. Secondly, persecution is inevitable. Don't try to run from it. You see, there's a quick, easy way to get out of persecution. You know what it is? Just shut up and fit in. And maybe you've been doing that. Maybe in this place, man, you are all in. It's hands in the air. I love you, Jesus. I'll do anything for you, Jesus. Because in here, it's easy. But out there, you ghost him. And you're routinely ghosting Jesus. Because let's face it, persecution may be inevitable, but persecution hurts, right? And so there is within us this desire to avoid it. And yet Jesus says, happy, blessed are the persecuted. And I'm like, how in the world could you say that? I mean, tell that to some eighth grade boy that's trying to walk with Christ at the junior high, and not even his church friends are with him on it. Tell that to the young girl who's trying to live with conviction, and as a result, she's marginalized because of her faith and she's missing some dates. Tell that to the young man who's trying to do business and he really needs to make that deal, but in doing so, he would have to compromise his convictions and values, and yet he really, really, really needs that deal. Tell that to the young mom who's trying to raise children of character, but everybody else wants children who are popular. And so she feels isolated and alone. Tell it to that missionary who's on the ragged edge out there somewhere, who's barely making ends meet. Or tell it to those pastors in North Korea or the Middle East, where suffering and persecution is a daily way of life. Happy are the persecuted? You got to be kidding me. So why would Jesus say that? Well, here it is. The happiness isn't in the experience, it's in the reward. It's in the reward. So happiness is in the reward. Look at Matthew 5, verse 12. He says, rejoice and be glad. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men revile you and say all manner of evil against you falsely on account of me. Rejoice and be glad. Why? Look, for your reward in heaven is great. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Now there are two ways to look at this, okay? And maybe both are right. The first way you can look at it is you can focus on what you gain in heaven. So there's obviously a future reward. He says, rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. You see that? And I think this is a powerful motivator that pushes people who are experiencing persecution through that momentary suffering. Because they know I've got an eternal reward. Jim Elliot said, he is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. And Jim Elliot died for Christ from some tribal Indians in the jungles of Ecuador. He knew, and he had an eternal perspective. And there's a power to that. There's also the future renown. It says, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. And so you look at that and you go, well, you know, I'm put in the same league as the heavyweights, and that's pretty cool. And so you receive that reward and that renown, and that's all future. And maybe that's it. But there's another way to look at this, and it really flows out of the structure, and I want to walk you through this, okay? You see, we always look at the Sermon on the Mount in two parts. We look at it as the introduction, which is Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 12, introduction, Beatitudes. And then we look at it as the body of the sermon, which is Matthew chapter 5, verse 13, down through 7:29. And so we got introduction and body. But what we tend to miss, because we dice this up this way, is that there is a bridge there between the Beatitudes and the body in 13, 14, and 15. Jesus talks about the fact that you are salt and you are light. And those two ideas flow together. If the eighth beatitude, blessed are those who are persecuted, is a summation of the first seven, you do the first seven, you get number eight. And then he begins to talk about you are the light, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It's good for nothing anymore except to be thrown out and trampled under the feet of men. You're the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do men light a lamp, put it under a peck measure or a basket, but on a lampstand it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they will see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. What does salt do? Ultimately, at the end of the day, what does salt do? Well, you say, well, it seasons things. Yeah, but what does it really do? It influences. You see, salt doesn't just make things taste salty. You put salt in cookies. Why? Because whatever you put salt in, it makes it more so. It influences. What does light do? Light influences. What did the prophets do? He says, because you're just like the prophets. What did the prophets do? They influenced. So what do you do when you're persecuted? You influence. Do you see how all of those ideas are tied together? So if you pull it back together and you really begin to understand it in that light, just as the prophets endured persecution to influence their world, your persecution proves your influence and God is using you like light and salt. And so there's a second way to see this. You can focus on what you gain in eternity or you can focus on what you gain in life. You see, persecution reminds me that I'm alive and doing something important. Man, we got to get to that. I got to tell you that it seems to me that our whole focus for life these days is comfort and convenience. You know, I can even call up Walmart now and I don't have to shop. They'll shop for me and I just pull up and they'll load it in my car. Brookshire's will do the same thing. I don't even have to shop anymore. I thought about that, and I thought my mother would have been put in prison if she had to do that, because here's the reason. The only thing Mom could do to get us out of her hair was take us to the grocery store. And she would tell us, y'all go pick your cereal. Well, back in the good old days, that's when they put the toys in the cereal. It was the worst possible cereal, had the best possible toys, and it would take us an hour to figure out which had the best toy. And we're looking at, you know, all of these, you know, sugar blast bombs and all that stuff, and that gave Mom an hour break at the grocery store. She had to go pick it up now. She'd lose her mind. But we got it where you pick up, they'll do your shopping for you. You pick up your groceries at the grocery store. If you're hungry, they'll bring your food to you. I mean, we used to, I don't want to cook, let's go out to eat. Okay, we'll go out to eat. I don't want to cook, I don't want to go out to eat, let's go pick up. Now I don't even have to do that. Call up the waiter app and have them bring it here. What are we going to do with all our time? What are we going to do with all our time? Sit around on social media and get more likes, or, you know, and I can imagine you're going to get to heaven and God's going to go, what'd you do with your time? And it's like, I was the high score on Red Dead Redemption. I smoked Fallout. That's nice. I had more likes than anybody on Instagram. Oh, wonderful. You see, persecution means that my life means something. I'm doing something. It's important. Look at verse 10. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. You see that? Blessed are those who've been persecuted for the sake of righteousness. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. I read that and I go, wait a minute. He already promised the kingdom of heaven to the poor in spirit. Back up, look at verse 3. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And we've already talked about this. When I recognize my spiritual poverty and I realize my sin means a death sentence, spiritually speaking, and there's nothing I can ever do, that my best works are like filthy rags, that I come to a point in saying, God, I am powerless over my sin and over my life. I am completely spiritually impoverished. I need the grace of Jesus Christ. The Bible says at that moment, God comes into my life and saves me, forgives my sin, and moves me from the domain of darkness into the kingdom of His beloved Son. Look at Colossians 1, verse 13. For He rescued us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of His beloved Son. In other words, I gain the kingdom through understanding my spiritual poverty. So why would He say it again? I mean, I've already got it, right? Blessed are the poor in spirit, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who've been persecuted, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And I looked at this and I thought, I was trying to feel it. You know, sometimes you got to feel it. I'm trying to feel it. What's the difference? And I think He's using the same words, but He's using them just slightly different. There's a slightly different meaning here. So let me try to explain it. When I'm poor in spirit, I gain the kingdom of heaven. But when I'm persecuted, I advance the kingdom of heaven. Do you feel it? Like the kingdom of heaven is mine when I'm poor in spirit. I get it. But the kingdom of heaven is mine when I'm persecuted. I own it. Does that make a little difference? It's like this. Being poor in spirit gets me on the team, but being persecuted puts me on the field. And there's an altogether different experience between the guy who's just on the team and the guy who's on the field. Does that make sense? You see, poor in spirit gets me the jersey. Maybe that'll help. But when I'm persecuted, I'm getting the jersey dirty. There's a lot of guys with clean jerseys in the church. They're on the team, but they haven't been on the field. Maybe this will work. With the poor in spirit, you're a player, but with the persecution, you're a playmaker. In the kingdom of heaven, the persecuted are the playmakers. The persecuted is Steph Curry with 10 seconds left in the game. It's Tom Brady with 2 minutes. When you're really in a bind and you need a play, you don't turn to those guys who are standing on the sidelines wearing the jerseys with no grass stains on them. You want your playmakers on the field. Because you know in the heat of the moment, Steph Curry's going to make that shot. Tom Brady's going to make that throw. Because he's a playmaker. They don't just make the team, they make the team great. And when you think about the reward to knowing that, if you're, you know, here it is. I've never been a coach, okay? Well, I take that back. I was a coach. I coached tackle too at OCS, so I have been a coach. I was defensive coordinator. I wasn't really the head coach, but it was a coach. But I've never really been a real coach. I've never really been in a real coaching meeting, so I don't know this for sure, so I can only guess. But if I'm an NFL coach and my team's about to play the Patriots, what do you think I'm talking about? I don't know this for sure, but I would assume there's a lot of discussion about Tom Brady. How are we going to slow down Tom Brady? Can we stop Tom Brady? You can't stop him. How can we slow him down? If I'm an NBA coach and I'm about to play the Golden State Warriors, I'm talking a lot about Steph Curry, right? How are we going to minimize Steph Curry? And this is what I realized. If I'm being persecuted, then that means the enemy's aware of me. You got it? And when the enemy pulls all his demons together in his coach's meeting, he's talking about me by name. So what does that tell you? It means I must be important enough for him to worry about me. And all of a sudden, the whole idea of reward changes for me. This isn't really about a better seat in heaven, and it's not about some brass plaque with my name on it next to the prophet. Persecution means the enemy is afraid of you, and he's trying to stop you. You see, we think about it as the reward is I'm going to get back something that was lost. But persecution's not trying to take things from you. Persecution is trying to stop you. And if the enemy is trying to stop you, that means that in the kingdom of heaven, you're doing important things. You're making enough of a difference that the opposition coaching staff wants to talk about you by name. So the reward is totally different. It's not a reward waiting in heaven. This is the reward of living a meaningful life right now. Your reward in heaven is great. Let me show you something in the original here, okay? The word translated reward isn't a reward like I go out and perform and I win a medal. That's Stephanos. It means the crown. It's not a reward or a crown. This is a reward that had to do with a paycheck or a payoff. Your reward is a payoff. And that word great is an interesting word Jesus used. The typical word for great there is mega. We get that, don't we? Mega millions, mega lottery, mega bucks, mega this, mega that. We got that, great. But the word he used is not that word. He used the word polis. And that word doesn't mean great. It means many or much. If you are a polygamist, that means you have many wives. You're a bit of an idiot, but you have many wives. If you're a polytheist, you have many gods. The word cosmopolitan means many worlds. So a cosmopolitan city would be a city with many different nations in it. You got it? The word polis means many or much. So when you put all this together, it says this, blessed are the persecuted, for their payoff in heaven comes in many different ways. Your life is kind of like lightning in a bottle. And when you release that lightning, those fingers of lightning in a lightning strike, lightning doesn't just strike in one spot. It strikes and reaches out in all different unpredictable ways. And that's what he's talking about. When you are persecuted, your influence, like salt and light, like the influence of the prophets, goes in all different directions, and your life has this incredible meaning. And so the reward isn't just what you get in heaven. The reward is an influential life right now. And who doesn't want that? Back in 1976, I had a friend that started listening to this guy named Bob Harrington on cassette tapes, and he got me to listen to them. And it was really one of the things that kind of got me to open up to Christianity, because Bob Harrington was a guy's guy. You know, he was 6'3", weighed about 240, and he would say, I can tear telephone books in half if they're small, you know. But Bob Harrington, after he got saved, said, I wanted to set up shop in the darkest place I could, so he went and became the chaplain of Bourbon Street. Joey, you remember that guy, Bob Harrington, the chaplain of Bourbon Street? And he put out these tapes. And there was this one particular tape, this one particular story I remember, where he talked about this bartender pouring beer over his head. And I thought, man, I'd love to find that story. So I got online, because a lot of people put stuff online, you know, those old tapes and stuff. And I found it on YouTube. And here's exactly how the story went. Bob Harrington talking. On Bourbon Street, I meet a lot of folks that are curious and interested and sometimes even a little bit harsh at me. This one particular bartender one day got a little irate. In fact, he got flat mad at me preaching. He had this old Mississippi Southern thing going. He said, I was standing on that street corner preaching, and he walks up and tore a page out of my Bible. Well, I knew what was on the other page, so I turned it over and kept preaching. And he took a mug of beer and poured it over my head, spraying it and all. Man, it just went down in my face. Bob's a big guy. He looks at the guy and he says, "Come here a minute." And he said, "What you gonna do?" I said, "Come here a minute." Guy walks over, he says, "I want to thank you for that." He said, "You want to thank me for pouring beer in your head?" "Yeah, I want to thank you." He said, "How come you want to thank me?" I said, "I know now I'm right with the Lord." He said, "Well, why do you know now?" I said, "Friend, when you poured that beer on my head, if I hadn't been right with the Lord, I'd have stomped you through that blacktop." He looked at me and said, "I'm glad you saved, preacher. I'm glad you saved." But then Bob said this, and this is the part I'd remembered, and this is the part I wanted you to hear. He said, this same bartender one night a little bit later, he was shot. And while he was laying there in a puddle of his own blood, you know who he said to call? "Call the preacher. Call the preacher." Bob said, "They might laugh at you right now, but let them get in a little trouble. You know who they're going to call? They're going to call somebody that believes." Let me say, I had that same experience, only I was the bartender. Not literally, but figuratively. We had this little run of a guy named Larry Legrone. Seventh grade, Larry Legrone. We called him Scrone, Larry Legrone. He's about 110 pounds, big old floppy hair, goofy kid. And he went out for football. Scrone was, he wasn't made for football, okay? And what we'd do is Scrone would get the ball and he'd be running like third team going against first team, and we'd hold him up to let other people hit him. You know, we're holding him up, and Scrone's going, "Let me down, let me down." So we'd finally tackle him down. Well, Scrone quit football in the eighth grade. It was a wise move on his part. And but after that, he kind of went deep into the drug deal. And by end of eighth grade, he was an eighth grade dope head. I'm telling you, he was. We called him Freaks. He was a freak. And we all knew it, and we just, you know, see him time, "Hey, Scrone, how's it going?" And then between his ninth grade and his 10th grade year, Larry Legrone got gloriously saved. He went off to camp or something. We don't know what happened. He came back a Christian, serious Christian, radical Christian, kind of Christian, carry his Bible to school. Now, you know, in the environment of Denison High School in those days, you're not going to let that go unchallenged. I mean, we didn't have "See You at the Pole" and all that other stuff. So if you were a Christian, you were walking with a very few number of people. And I remember, I don't know that I persecuted Larry. I just made life hard for him. You know, I didn't see him all the time. When I'd see him, I'd just kind of bump into him. And, you know, you don't think about it. You think about it now. But when you're being a bully, you don't think about it. That I outweighed Larry by about 70 pounds. And what it might be like to just have somebody kind of knocking you around like that and going, "Hey, Bible banger, hey, Bible thumper, what a Jesus freak got to say today. What's Jesus saying the Bible about that? You know, when you going to come out to the party and party with us and do stuff like that?" And it's not really stuff that, you know, is going to wreck your world, but it's kind of stuff that it's really hard to hear when you're in high school. And for high schoolers, man, that penetrates deep. Larry just always smiled and kind of took it and said, "Man, God still loves you." You know, he'd do that kind of thing. And I realized, I knew even then, I respected him. I respected him. And I knew he was tougher than me. I knew that. And about 4 years later, when my world got rocked, guess who I called? I said, "I need to talk to Larry Legrone." I hadn't talked to Larry Legrone in probably over a year. I need to talk to Larry Legrone. And I called him up. And Larry Legrone led me to Jesus. Scrone led me to Jesus. That little old scrawny, floppy-haired guy that never quit and never gave up. He's the one that influenced me. Blessed are the persecuted, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Man, there's a blessing there that you got to get your head around. Life counts. And is there any greater gift than that? See, here's the thing. The poor in spirit make the team, but the persecuted make the team great. They're the playmakers. They're the ones that when it's on the line, God says, I need to be sure that guy's in the game. So can I ask you a question? Have you ever been persecuted? I mean, if persecution is a normal part of the Christian life, have you ever been persecuted? Why not? Do you want your life to count, or you just want to be comfortable and convenient? You know, God's got better for you. Not only do you get a reward and you get renown, but you get a full and meaningful life right now. There's not a better offer out there today. So how about we do this? Let's stop ghosting Jesus. And let's start taking Jesus out of this place with us into whatever environment we move into. If it's business, He goes with us there. If it's school, He goes with us there. If it's a meeting, wherever we go, He goes. And when people begin to resent that, you just smile and realize, hey, I'm no longer on the team. Now I'm on the field. Let's pray together. Father, thank you for the privilege of persecution. It's hard for us to understand, especially in America, because we can just quietly avoid it by just staying silent. In other places, it's not so easy. And I pray for our brothers who are deeply persecuted around the world. But even here, God, for that young boy, that young girl, that couple, that mom, that dad, that businessman, that businesswoman, Father, help them to realize that this is part of it and that you have a blessing in it. It's the blessing of happiness, of knowing that no matter what touches us in this world, that you've already prepared eternity for us. But it's also the blessing of right now, of knowing, hey, when the enemy's making his game plan, he's thinking about me. My name's on his list, which means I got to be doing something right. And Father, I pray that we would no longer be satisfied with just being in the kingdom, but that we would spend our days making the kingdom great. Raise up playmakers. And we thank you for that in Jesus' name. Amen.